It's like Magic, Kobe. They're like, they're Mount Rushmore of L.A.
A lot of people are saying today's the day that part of L.A. died.
Kobe was one of my favorite players. So to see that he's dead, it makes me sad.
What Kobe Bryant meant for sports and culture across the world, and why his death and complicated legacy has so many feeling stunned today. I'm Arun Vanigopal, and this is The Takeaway for January 27th. Also on the show, the novel American Dirt is being scrutinized for misrepresenting the immigrant experience. We'll hear from two authors on how to write about communities you aren't a part of.
That idea of I want to feel your pain, oftentimes that's where the thought process stops. And I think the next question to always ask yourself is, for what purpose?
Plus, we take a look at how Indian Americans have been protesting the passage of India's new citizenship law, which discriminates against Muslims. But we begin with a story that hits close to home. Let's get going. The Trump administration's hostile attitude towards the news media escalated over the weekend following an exchange in which Secretary of State Mike Pompeo verbally berated veteran NPR reporter Mary Louise Kelly. On Friday morning, the All Things Considered co-host interviewed Pompeo about the administration's Iran policy before pressing him on Ukraine and the treatment of former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch.
Do you owe Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch an apology?
You know, I agreed to come on your show today to talk about Iran. That's what I intend to do. I know what our Ukraine policy has been now for the 3 years of this administration. I'm proud of the work we've done. This administration delivered the capability for the Ukrainians to defend themselves. President Obama showed up with MREs. We showed up with Javelin missiles. Previous administration did nothing to take down corruption in Ukraine. We're working hard on that. We're going to continue to do it.
I confirmed with your staff last night that I would talk about Iran and Ukraine.
Anything else to say about that this morning.
But what's most notable is what happened after the interview ended. Here's what Kelly told her All Things Considered co-host Ari Shapiro.
I was taken to the secretary's private living room where he was waiting and where he shouted at me for about the same amount of time as the interview itself had lasted. He was not happy to have been questioned about Ukraine. He asked, do you think Americans care about Ukraine? He used the F word in that sentence and many others. He asked if I could find Ukraine on a map. I said yes. He called out for his aides to bring him a map of the world with no writing, no countries marked.
Huh.
I pointed to Ukraine. He put the map away. He said, people will hear about this. And then he turned and said he had things to do. And I thanked him again for his time and left.
Pompeo has since issued a statement accusing Kelly of lying to him and saying, quote, this is another example of how unhinged the media has become in its quest to hurt President Trump and this administration. But according to NPR CEO John Lansing, Kelly has an email chain with an aide to Pompeo confirming that they would be talking about Ukraine. It's the latest example of the Trump administration demonizing members of the media and creating a narrative that doesn't seem to square with the facts. And it's where we're going to start today on The Takeaway. For more on this, we turn to Kelly McBride, Senior Vice President and Chair of the Craig Newmark Center for Ethics and Leadership at the Poynter Institute. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Jane Kirtley, Media Ethics and Law Professor at the University of Minnesota. Jane, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Kelly, how did this whole episode strike you?
Really fairly typical, considering this administration's relationship with the press. I think when you look at both stories, Secretary Pompeo's and Mary Louise Kelly, it seems to be that Mary Louise Kelly's version is completely consistent and believable, and I think she just did a really good professional interview, and Pompeo was unprepared and therefore lashed out.
Jane, what do you make of this incident?
This is the latest in a long series of clashes that Secretary Pompeo has had with the press and particularly with women journalists. I don't really like to play the gender card, but it's hard to avoid the appearance here that his disrespect and use of profanity and bullying with this particular journalist are simply symptomatic of a viewpoint that I think permeates the administration. As they say, the fish rots from the head, and I think that's what's going on here.
Kelly, I was really impressed by how Mary Louise Kelly handled herself during the interview and also following Pompeo's subsequent attacks. What are the lessons for journalists from this?
Yeah, I agree. I was impressed as well. First of all, go in prepared and have neutral questions that are not argumentative in their nature. And then I think also listen to the response that you're getting and be prepared to counter that response, because what we hear so much coming out of Washington is spin. And the key thing that Mary Louise did in that interview was she listened to what Pompeo was saying and was able to call him out on his misdirection. And that, you can tell, that's where the tenor of the conversation really changed for him.
Jane, any lessons to add to that?
I would say the other interesting thing is the email trail that Mary Louise had and was able to demonstrate that, in fact, she had dealt with Secretary Pompeo's staff, had explained what the parameters of the interview were going to be, had refused to be tied down to one narrow set of questions, left the door open. He had due notice of where she was going to go with this, and his feigning of surprise, I think, is completely artificial.
Is the fact that she actually did recount to Ari Shapiro afterward the nature of her exchange, her off-the-mic exchange with Secretary Pompeo, that seems to be striking in terms of allowing herself, if you will, to be part of the story unavoidably. Am I right, Kelly?
A little unusual, although I think completely relevant in this case. This man is fourth in line in succession to the presidency, and if his ability to react under pressure certainly has bearing on how he would do in that job. Also, I think it puts the proper context on what we heard on her recording, which is evasion and then an abrupt end to the interview. And so I think it was completely appropriate and informative to me as a citizen.
Jane, how important is it for journalists to confront this behavior?
You know, it's critical. The thing that separates mature democracies like the United States from more autocratic countries is that journalists speak truth to power. They are, in some respects, an adversarial relationship with the government, at least in the sense of holding the government to account and not simply acting as public relations arms. And for me, for Mary Louise to explain exactly what happened, some might call that inside baseball, but to me, it's providing the public a window with how this administration regards not just journalists, but the members of the public who rely on journalists for truthful and accurate information about what the government is up to.
Kelly, Pompeo's had a pretty rocky relationship with the press. When else have we seen him behave like this?
You know, there's been many, many instances, and I gotta just agree with Jane that his disregard for the public that Mary Louise was representing, particularly in his comment of, you know, I bet you can't even find Ukraine, implying that no sensible human being would know where Ukraine is in the universe and therefore shouldn't care about that, is, I think, just a key driver in NPR's decision-making here.
Jane, there's clearly an overt pattern on the part of the Trump administration. I would call it authoritarian. Does the U.S. news media need to be more willing to call out this behavior for what it is?
We have to do that. And I think it's really important that we not allow those who are the supporters of the president or the enemies of the press in general to suggest that it is inappropriate, wrong, disrespectful, unpatriotic. I mean, pick your adjective. It's none of these things when journalists challenge what the government is saying. Again, it's what separates us from autocracies. I mean, there's a reason that people listen to NPR. There's a reason that people listen to Russia Today, I guess, but they get two completely different versions of the world when they do that. And, you know, again, we have to be telling the public that this is what your elected and appointed officials are doing and saying, and this is why you need to care about it.
And Jane, you have experience working with the State Department as a journalist. How does its relationship with the news media today compare to previous administrations' State Departments?
I've done work with the administration, or the State Department, since the Bush administration, the first Bush administration. And although obviously there were times when the government didn't agree with the way the press was covering things, there was always a basic respect for the role for freedom of the press. And in our consulates and embassies around the world, we try to convey that message. And it seems to me that this kind of disconnect can only look like, at best, hypocrisy on our part. It's a fundamental problem in terms of promoting civil society and the democratic systems that we all want to see in place around the world.
Kelly, this controversy raises a lot of questions about how we as journalists actually do our job. Could you walk us through what off-record and on-record how that works, especially in situations like this with government officials?
Well, in general, when a journalist is willing to go off the record, she would signal that. And she would signal it for a very specific reason. She's looking for a key piece of information that cannot be tied to an individual. In this case, there was no motivation to do that. When a source wants to go off the record, they usually indicate ahead of time, I would like to go off the record, and it's important to know that the journalist has to agree to it. There's been many cases where somebody has emailed something unsolicited to a journalist and said, this is off the record, and the journalist has no ability to consent to that. That's not how off the record works, and certainly Secretary Pompeo understands that.
And Kelly, President Trump weighed in on Twitter about this. He basically questioned the existence of NPR. Could this situation, this episode, have an impact on funding?
Well, every time NPR does critical coverage of Congress or the White House, someone threatens public media funding. NPR itself gets very little funding, although the member stations that are affiliated with NPR get a lot more funding from the government. It could, and I think most people in public media are aware that the government may interrupt their funding as a way of retribution, and I think they're prepared to live with those consequences.
Jane, everyone I know is talking about this, but of course I work in public media. Do you think people outside the media bubble actually care about this?
Well, I hope they do. I think that we have a long series of examples going back to the inauguration of the Trump administration twisting the truth, distorting the facts, and showing disrespect for journalists and for the public at large. I would hope that the mere accumulation of these things would finally start to register. But the trouble is we are living in such a fractionated kind of environment today that many people are just choosing up sides and taking the version of the truth that most comports with the way they want to see the world. All journalists can do is keep reporting on this.
Kelly, real quick, what does this whole thing, this whole ordeal mean for the American public?
Well, I mean, Jane's right. We have a polarized public, and the people who support NPR and support journalists holding the government to account, I think, are behind the journalism, and we're seeing a rise in trust among that portion of the population. People who support the administration generally have a dim view of journalists, and they probably are. Have a dimmer view as a result of this interaction. I don't think that that's going to change. It's going to exacerbate the polarization.
Kelly McBride is Senior Vice President and Chair of the Craig Newmark Center for Ethics and Leadership at the Poynter Institute. Jane Kirtley is a Media Ethics and Law Professor at the University of Minnesota. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Most times when you stay up late and you work hard, those times when you don't feel like working, you're too tired, you don't want to push yourself, but you do it anyway. That is actually the dream. That's the dream. It's not the destination, it's the journey.
It's so hard to say goodbye to you.
We love you, Colby.
Sounds from the Grammys last night at the Staples Center in L.A., the building where the Black Mamba made his legacy. Alicia Keys and Boyz II Men paid tribute to basketball legend Kobe Bryant, who died Sunday at the age of 41. He was one of nine killed during a helicopter crash in Calabasas, California, along with his teenage daughter Gianna. On the court, Bryant, an 18-time All-Star and five-time champion, was considered one of the greatest basketball players in NBA history. And the news of his death sent shockwaves around the world. Social media lit up with tributes and memories. His work for women's basketball, various charities, and being a hands-on father were highlighted by celebrities and world leaders. And more than anything, his millions of fans. Off the court, his legacy is a bit more complicated. Kobe was accused of rape early in his career in 2003, though the charges were later dropped. It's part of a very complex life that we're going to talk about. Here with me now are Jamel Hill, staff writer at The Atlantic, and Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Jamel, how are you feeling right now?
Well, I mean, I think like a lot of people, still trying to process this. You know, I was trying to think over the course of my lifetime if there had been a death that was more shocking and that it hit me this hard. And I really couldn't, you know, think of one, certainly not from a sports perspective. Sports writers and people I know who are a little bit older than me, they talk about this is very comparable to Roberto Clemente, just in the fact that he was somebody who, you know, the way he died and to die so tragically and at that point in his life. But, you know, for me, this is this probably hits harder than more than any other death that I can remember. And maybe some of it has to do with the fact that I had a personal relationship with Kobe, or maybe it's just because he's somebody who I literally watched grow up before my eyes. But it certainly still has not sunk in, at least for me, that, you know, he's gone.
Dave, how is the sports community reacting, especially his former teammates?
Well, the sports community is reacting, as you might expect, because Kobe was an icon well beyond the world of sports. I mean, for them, Kobe was the generational player, the touchstone. You know, a generation earlier, it was Michael Jordan. For this generation, it's Kobe Bryant. And they saw him as somebody who not only was an all-time great player, fourth all-time leading scorer, 18-time All-Star, but also saw him as somebody who was going to blaze new trails after retirement. He was going to become not somebody who did basketball commentary or become a coach or even become a franchise owner like Michael Jordan. He was going to move beyond the world of basketball and become a trailblazer in a whole new walk of life. And so they're feeling very acutely that they were robbed of this second act of Kobe's life, which was going to be all the more remarkable. And it also has to be said that in recent years, you know, Kobe had sort of become almost like this godfather type figure to a lot of young players because they did look up to him and he had time back for them. And so the tributes have just been pouring in of heartbroken players. And if I have to say, like, I think the NBA really should have canceled their games yesterday, because when you saw the heartache on the players' face and the tears in their eyes, I mean, that just, you know, should have been a time for them to mourn, because mourning is what took place across the NBA.
Jamel, I want to paint a scene described on Facebook by my friend, photographer B.A. Van Size, from yesterday night. He recounted being at the arrivals area of JFK Airport, and he said, watching four young African-American security guards crying together because Kobe Bryant has died. Does his death especially mean something for Black fans?
Yeah, I definitely think that it's a significant loss for the Black community. Even though Kobe, obviously, the love that people have for him, it transcended a lot of races, obviously genders as well. It's an especially big blow because he was a player that the way that he played, and because so much of his game reminded people of Michael Jordan, and the style and the charisma and the dashing way, just stylistically how he played the game of basketball, connected with a lot of African-American fans. And so to know that this is the end, and even though he was in retirement and all that, I think for a lot of fans, a lot of Black fans in particular, you know, it just feels like a piece of the community's soul is gone because of what he meant.
May I say something to that as well?
Sure thing.
It's just, I mean, and Jamel wrote about this so beautifully in this achingly painful piece in The Atlantic, but the degree to which in recent years Kobe Bryant also picked up the mantle of defense, of using his star power and his cultural capital to defend someone like Colin Kaepernick, to lift up Trayvon Martin's family. I mean, he was acquiring a place in the community that made him more than an athlete.
And Jamel, you note that that wasn't how he always was based on your early conversations with him after the death of Trayvon Martin in 2012.
Yeah, it's interesting in talking about his relationship with the African-American community, because I think there was a time where it wasn't a very good one. And there were some people who thought that he was maybe aloof and distant from the community, even though there was nothing he necessarily said or did. But there was just this feeling that he wasn't as connected as he should be. And when he made those comments about Trayvon Martin, and I think that really opened his eyes to a lot of things. There was a tremendous amount of backlash by Black fans for what he said. And, you know, for him to kind of rectify that, to not just apologize to Trayvon Martin's family, but then to later speak at one of his rallies. And then to go on when Michael Brown was killed, and he immediately reacted to that as a Black man, not just as an athlete. And for the money that he gave to the National African American History Museum in D.C., him and his wife and their foundation, he, as Dave said, he had definitely strengthened that bond with the community. And that is, I think, in part why it feels like such a deep, tragic, just a senseless loss.
In Esquire, Charles Pierce wrote, "Kobe Bryant died on Sunday with one of the young women in his life, and how you will come to measure his life has to be judged by how deeply you believe that he corrected his grievous fault through the life he lived afterwards." In that sense, Dave, did he address in some manner, subtly perhaps, the allegations of rape? Did he come to correct it in a way that you think redeemed him in some regard?
I'm really not one to judge on that question. I know that his relationship with his daughters was something real and beautiful, and something he wore on his sleeve so everybody could see it. And I know that he is somebody who tried to live his life as if it was in a redemptive arc from those horrific times from 2003-2005. And the one thing I hope is like that people recognize that people are going to grieve about this in different ways and from different communities. And I just hope we don't police each other's grief, because people are going to respond to this in very emotional and very different ways.
I want to play a clip of Kobe on Jimmy Kimmel in 2018 talking mm-hmm. about his daughter, Gianna, and how she reacted to people saying he needed a son to carry on his legacy.
The best thing that happens is when we go out and fans will come up to me, and she'll be standing next to me, and they'll be like, "Hey, you got to have a boy. You and V got to have a boy, man. You got somebody carry on the tradition, the legacy." She's like, "Oi, I got this."
Dave, how much was his retirement devoted to his daughter's basketball career?
Well, it's interesting. He became a coach of his daughter's youth team. He traveled with them. He became an advocate for the WNBA. He became somebody who saw women's basketball not as women's basketball, but as basketball. And his daughter had these aspirations, Gigi, of playing at the University of Connecticut, which for listeners who don't know is like the platinum-plated program in all of college basketball. And so Kobe's commitment to women's basketball, it became ironclad, but it has to be said that it didn't happen because Kobe was pushing his daughter Gigi to play. It happened because Gigi got the bug and came to love basketball, and actually, as Kobe described it, dragged him back into the world of basketball when he was planning on leaving it following retirement.
You thought the NBA should have canceled yesterday's game. It erred by not doing that, in your opinion. Going forward, what should the NBA be doing?
I mean, I don't think there's anything they could do that's too big at this point. I think they should rename the Staples Center, where Kobe played for 20 years, the Kobe Bryant Center. I think teams should consider retiring his number. The Dallas Mavericks have already said they would do so, so no one else would ever be number 24 for the Mavericks. And I think arenas are going to have to become places of collective mourning, because this was a figure who stood astride the basketball world for two decades, and you can't just erase that.
All right, a lot to think about there regarding Kobe Bryant's legacy. That was Jamel Hill from The Atlantic and Dave Zirin from The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. We want to hear your thoughts on this also. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number here on The Takeaway.
Dear Basketball, from the moment I started rolling my dad's tube socks, and shooting imaginary game-winning shots in the Great Western Forum. I knew one thing was real. I fell in love with you. A love so deep, I gave you my all. From my mind and body, to my spirit and soul.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
By now, you might have heard about the controversy surrounding the new book, American Dirt. If you haven't, here's the gist. Author Janine Cummins' novel centers on a Mexican woman who flees Mexico with her son for a new life in the U.S. At first, the critical praise poured in for the book, but it wasn't long before louder voices pointed out ways in which the novel seemed to misrepresent the immigrant experience, something that Cummins doesn't have firsthand knowledge of. Here on The Takeaway that got us thinking, how do you go about writing for someone who's not like you? That's a question I put to Nisi Shawl, creator of the writing workshop Writing the Other, and author most recently of the 2016 Nebula Award finalist Everfair, as well as author Caitlin Greenidge, whose debut novel We Love You, Charlie Freeman, was one of the New York Times' top 10 books of 2016. Caitlin opens our conversation.
So if it's a white author writing a minority character, oftentimes when you're writing a person of color or a black person, especially if it's taking place sort of in a U.S. context, I think a lot of writers are hyper aware of negative stereotypes. And, you know, there is the tendency to sort of overcorrect into sainthood.
Yes.
And both of those extremes don't really allow for a human character. And so I think the mistake often sort of goes to making these characters into people who can't make mistakes, people who can't be wrong, and oftentimes people who exhibit goodness and moral fortitude in a way that a white middle class reader would recognize those themes. So, like, I often see if someone is writing The Other, you know, they'll say, you know, they were poor, or they were black, or they were brown, but they love books. Or, like, they were poor, they were black, or they were brown, or they, like, could understand a symphony. Mm-hmm, you know, all these sort of markers that for a middle class reader reads as, like, they're human like me, that I think sort of oftentimes someone will add, thinking they're adding character or texture to a character, but really don't tell us much except sort of your own bias around taste.
There is a certain kind of like, oh, I want to feel your pain, and this is my act of, you know, identifying with you and elevating your experience without necessarily putting in the work and maybe perhaps co-opting a group's sort of life experience narrative in a way that is not necessarily, I don't know, for lack of a better word, authentic or experience in any way.
Yeah, I think that idea of I want to feel your pain, oftentimes that's where the thought process stops. And I think the next question to always ask yourself is, for what purpose? Am I feeling your pain to feel better as a person, knowing that I'm able to feel empathy for another person? Which is sort of circles back to yourself again and isn't really about the person you're feeling, whose pain you're feeling. Am I feeling your pain because I think that's going to help, you know, another thing that people like to talk about is like raise awareness or sort of give voice to people. And maybe if you start with the assumption that those communities already know that they are human, they already know many of the issues facing them. So you sort of identifying their pain does what to what end?
Niecy, can you talk about your own work and to the extent to which you've had to kind of grapple with these issues as someone who's imparting this sort of instruction to writers? How have you had to confront that in your own experience?
So a lot of what I do is get people to get away from those extremes. The idea is that people are saying someone who is different isn't really different from me. They're like white inside or something like that. Or then the other extreme is someone who is different is so different and so exotic. They're just so weird and quaint. You know, let's just focus in on all these differences. So one of the specific exercises I have people do in my classes is look at two photographs with two different subjects and talk about first how they are different and then how they are the same, so that you don't get stuck in one extreme, so that you have a little more nuance and balance. And so that's one of the exercises that I take people through.
Niecy, for some writers, science fiction is a way to rethink or break out of ways of thinking about contemporary issues, right? I mean, to envision social futures. But do you also see the same stereotypes and reductionist writing of minority characters in science fiction?
Yes, and that is part of what I was trying to address in writing essays and the book and teaching the class. And I think science fiction community still has work to do in this, but I think we're ahead of what we would call the mimetic or the literary mainstream because it has been brought to our attention a little earlier.
Caitlin, do you think there's a fine line between writing that is trying to raise awareness about important issues in certain communities and outright cultural appropriation of pain and hardship?
I don't think the goal should be you're only ever allowed to write about your own race, gender, time period, and social class, right? I think we would lose a lot of interesting novels and interesting experiments and interesting failures if that was the goal of this whole conversation. I think the goal is to ask a lot of questions of oneself beforehand and shift a lot of expectations, just sort of givens around when a book comes out. In terms of sort of like this idea of a novel raising awareness or somehow like helping an issue like a big social novel, I think perhaps letting go of that ideal of a social novel is where this conversation could go and where we could actually sort of expand this conversation and make it into something interesting. Because I'm not sure what we want when we say we want a social novel or a novel to raise awareness. I think probably the big example in everybody's mind is a novel like Uncle Tom's Cabin, which for white literary history is a success in a certain way. But for Black readers has always been, from its publication, a contested book and a book that has a lot of feelings, a lot of critiques around it, that every generation, a white mainstream reader says, we never heard this before. when in fact, you know, since day one, we've been in conversation with this. So if we can shift that focus from sort of continual innocence and surprise of like, oh my goodness, it didn't occur to me that this could be an issue, and actually look at the long history of this occurring every generation and at this rate that we are accelerating at every, you know, couple months, every book cycle, we can maybe move forward in some sort of way and figure out what that line is.
Niecy, any advice you have for writers who are thinking about writing about the other and which you think is useful in helping someone pursue a project?
Yes, eschew extremes. The binary is a lie. Look for the nuance. And, you know, in my classes, I talk about ways to write the other, but also I talk about how to support own voices. We have a unit that I teach called Being a Social Justice Bard. And I think, yeah, look into doing the kinds of things that will support representation in your own work and in the field at large.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times when writers and also readers talk about reading about someone who is not like themselves, there's often sort of like this moralizing part of it, like I'm feeling better, it makes me a better person. And, you know, maybe there's some truth to that. You know, you don't know what's inside everybody's mind, but I'm not really sure how to what end that sort of goes to when you sort of frame reading and interacting in that way. And yeah. I'll also say, like, you know, when I have students, and I think from teachers that I've learned, kind of the best question that I've had is if you're drawn to a particular story, treat your curiosity not as just a given or as a sort of neutral thing, and sort of really ask yourself, why am I drawn to this particular story, this particular identity, this particular status or way of being in the world?
Right. Actually asking yourself that before you even start writing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really important thing. And it doesn't have to be a flagellation. It doesn't have to be, you know, I'm a horrible, you know, person for being interested in this person who is not like myself. It can be actually really thinking historically, culturally, for this particular moment, why am I interested in this story?
Yeah. And also the idea that you may be taking attention away from someone who has a legitimate and lived experience with what you're trying to depict.
Nisi Shaul is the creator of the writing workshop Writing the Other and is the author most recently of the 2016 Nebula Award finalist Everfair. And Caitlin Greenidge is an author whose debut novel, We Love You, Charlie Freeman, was one of the New York Times' top 10 books of 2016. Thanks so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
I had a great time.
Hi, everybody. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway. As protests in India continue against a law that grants citizenship based on religion, members of the South Asian diaspora here in the United States have also taken to the streets to join the fight. Yesterday marked India's Republic Day, and thousands of protesters gathered in cities across the country to call on India's government and the Trump administration to take action against the discriminatory law.
Fascism, when it takes roots in a country, cannot be eradicated unless the world puts pressure and intervenes.
Especially the United States can make a huge difference because the United States, as we all like it or not, is the police of the world.
I'm pregnant 8 months, but I don't want my daughter to grow up being of Indian origin and then belonging to a country where all she's hearing is that it's such a divisive environment, and this entire situation with the CAA, that would probably be the first big law that she will hear about when she comes into this world.
Those were protesters in New York and D.C. on Sunday. And for more on these protests within the South Asian diaspora, I'm joined by Rashmi Kumar of The Intercept. Thanks for coming on the show, Rashmi.
Thanks for having me.
Rashmi, give us a quick overview of why these protesters gathered over the weekend.
The intentions behind the protests primarily were to show solidarity with the protesters in India who, for the past 40 or so days, have been protesting against the Citizenship Amendment Act. So I think this was, as you said, trying to persuade the Trump administration to censure the Modi government in some way and to criticize what's going on. They also sent a letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo asking him to take a stand against the Citizenship Amendment Act.
So let's talk about the one, at least in New York. I mean, these were taking place in cities across the country. I observed the New York demonstration just as you did. And it was apparent to me, at least, that there were a lot of Muslim Americans there, mm-hmm. people who'd come on buses from various other cities. It seemed to be a fairly broad coalition.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised to see like how many people actually showed up. I think people were protesting in front of the Indian consulate near Central Park. There was a lot going on, lots of chanting, Indian flags being waved, lots of speeches from Muslim people who were talking about how they felt their Indian identity was being threatened. I noted how it was very intergenerational. There were like young kids running around, older people, and, you know, families like on the sidelines, like eating lunch and drinking chai together. Like it had like this community feel to it, as well as also being a protest.
In terms of gatherings, just several months ago, we had this event in Houston, Howdy Modi, which drew 50,000 people right. in support of him. So, you know, that was bigger than any other gathering I've ever seen in the community here. Is one side just significantly sort of out-organizing the other?
Yeah, for sure. The biggest Indian-American demonstration or rally I've been to was Howdy Modi. I think that's like definitely something very important to note when talking about the differences between how progressive South Asian-American groups are mobilized and how the Indian-American right and the Hindu right in the U.S. are mobilized. Howdy Modi really showed me, like, not only the sheer scale of support in the U.S. for Modi, but also how organized Modi's supporters are in the U.S. You know, an event like that definitely takes years to organize and coordinate. It was the efforts of several organizations, particularly this nonprofit group that was created basically to put on the event, led by prominent members of Hindu nationalist linked groups in the U.S. and, you know, getting Trump to show up.
Yeah.
Just like the sheer scale of it really demonstrates how organized Modi supporters are in the U.S.
One thing you write in your article in The Intercept is that Hindu nationalist organizations have historically portrayed themselves as liberal, social, and religious groups that denounce bigotry and uphold equality. And you're referring to groups in this country. Why is that significant?
I think that really goes back to kind of the emergence of Hindu nationalist groups in the U.S., where in the 1980s, 1990s, these groups were forming with the help of the RSS, which is the parent organization of a bunch of Hindu nationalist groups in India. They were spreading to the diaspora, primarily in the U.S. The Hindu nationalist movement was growing over there, and some Hindu Americans here identified with that because they felt like minorities here. And the way that Hindu nationalist groups in the U.S. have manifested and operated is as religious groups and cultural groups, and they put on like cultural activities and celebrations for the holidays. I think on the surface, Hindu nationalist groups in the U.S. portray themselves as liberal and supporting equality and upholding like religious plurality and things like that. But, you know, we're increasingly seeing the other side of things where they are also very mobilized politically and actively supporting the Modi government and the BJP.
How is this manifested amongst presidential contenders like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, people like Tulsi Gabbard, who've historically been aligned very closely with Hindu groups over here?
I think Bernie Sanders has probably been the most outspoken among Democratic presidential candidates. He has criticized the Modi government's actions against Kashmir. He spoke out last month. The Indian foreign minister refused to meet with the House Foreign Affairs Committee because Representative Pramila Jayapal was going to be there. And the Indian officials who were here didn't want to meet with her.
Have we heard anyone who's been voicing support in the last couple months, given how the protests have been like really building up?
I think the overt support is mostly coming from Republicans, and there have also been a lot of lobbying efforts from the Indian government around trying to recruit more congresspeople to support India's actions.
How do protesters see their role right now? What's their endgame?
I spoke with one of the organizers of the New York protest. I think there is a limitation in how much influence the Indian American diaspora can like actually have on Indian policy. The diaspora can try to influence the U.S. government here to take some sort of stand. Those kinds of lobbying efforts have been happening around Kashmir. You know, Pramila Jayapal put out her House resolution condemning the internet blackout in Kashmir. So there is that mobilizing happening in Congress for sure.
Rashmi Kumar is with The Intercept. Thanks, Rashmi.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Earlier in the hour, we talked about the death of NBA legend Kobe Bryant, and we want to hear from you. What did his legacy mean to you, and how are you feeling in the wake of his death? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway.